Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to this, the inaugural episode of Interop Radio's Business Matters. I'm Kurt Franklin, executive editor at Information Week, and the producer of this series of shows. This is going to be a great series. We have a new host on Interop Radio, George Colombo. And George has lined up a great guest for us today. I'm going to let him tell you all about his guest. But before he does, I want to remind everyone that the audio portion of Interop Radio is just a piece of what makes this special. The other part is our live online text conversation that's already begun at Information Week. And to be part of that, all you have to do is type your comment or question into the box labeled your post, then be sure and click on that big red post button under the box. Now, at the end of our audio portion, George and his guest will be joining that conversation. So now is the right time to go ahead and introduce yourself. You're going to find that we are a very supportive community. Get your comments and questions lined up. Well, that's enough of me. So, George, I'm going to hand it over to you to begin today's show.
Kurt, more exciting than I can tell you. You know, you and I have worked together before, and I think this project is going to touch on a variety of topics over time that are certainly they'll be interesting to me, and I think they'll be interesting to our listeners as well. As Kurt mentioned, our inaugural guest today is somebody very special. It is former Air Force Brigadier General John Michel, who actually I came across him one day when he showed up in my Twitter feed. Some people that I follow had retweeted some of the general's posts, and his voice was intriguing to me. I began following him myself, and it quickly became clear to me that his insight and his perspective were unique. And when the opportunity to bring him on today presented itself, I just couldn't have been more excited. So let me tell you just a little bit about General Michel. He is a 26-year veteran with the United States Air Force. His most recent assignment was leading NATO's 14-nation effort in Afghanistan to build their Air Force. He developed organizational requirements, messaging, and really did the whole thing. The general is in private industry now with MV International, which is the largest private provider of paratransit services and the largest privately owned passenger transportation contracting firm in the country. So, General Michel, welcome.
Well, thank you for that very gracious introduction. And no, it's a joy and privilege to be able to spend time with you and the listening audience and just sharing some ideas and perspectives on leadership across a whole host of dimensions.
Well, let's just dive right in. And I want to start with, I guess, a definition. How do you define leadership? What is it, and how does it differ from just plain management?
Now, that's a great starter question. One, I will tell you, leadership in its simplest form is influence. And if you, what that means is we all have the ability to affect things in our surroundings. It could be as a parent, it could be as an administrator, it could be as a someone in a specific role in a company, and it really doesn't matter when it comes down to this notion of if you believe leadership is influence, it then allows you to enter the conversation to go, everyone's capable of being a leader, which I absolutely agree. I also believe that this informs the notion that this concept of are leaders born or made. If we all have influence, I think it shows that we're all capable of being leaders, which means it's an ongoing developmental process. So in answering that question, I kind of give you the overarching frame that leadership is a journey that we're all on. Some choose to be more intentional than others. And I think that that is really then where we could possibly take the conversation from here.
And that's something that's clear in your book. I want to get back to that, but I'm curious about one thing. How do you find the dynamics of leadership to be different in the civilian world than it was for you in the military?
Well, again, another great question. In terms of the various elements, one thing I will say about the military is there is a clarity of mission and purpose that exists with virtually everybody. So as a person in a leadership role, the work to be able to get people motivated behind a particular task or, again, in what we're trying to achieve, I found actually many regards easier in the military. Because, again, the sense of deep culture that's developed very intentionally over time, the fact that we have a shared set of beliefs that is also developed very early on when someone enters the military and we kind of normalize or kind of standardize how we think about our roles, getting people on mission or to focus on outcomes in a specific way, I found easier. In the civilian realm, that level of clarity isn't there. And I believe that really informs then the really successful leaders I've seen so far in my, and I've been studying leaders, I've been teaching leaders throughout my whole career, both in the civilian realm, even when I was in the military, and certainly now, are those that are very effective and very intentional at being able to provide clarity to individuals, really help people paint a picture about what they're asking and expecting to do and why it's important, that kind of sense of why we need to do this and how it's going to either affect our business performance, how it's going to better serve our customers. So in the civilian world, I have found that those who can actually spend the time to articulate and make sure that people have clear understanding, they are more effective. And so that role, again, is done across a lifetime in the military, and I even have to find myself spending a little more time in that arena if I'm going to be able to get the team to move in the direction I need them to move.
That's interesting. Now, just to follow this train of thought just a little further, in your experience, what does an organization with effective leadership look like? What does it feel like? And how does it differ from an organization where the leadership isn't quite as effective?
Well, I'll tell you, it starts with back to clarity of purpose, which manifests in passion for the mission. It's in a willingness to trust and in one another, and in that trust, being willing to take and smart risks. So organizations where they're a well-developed sense of leadership, where, again, every individual understands clearly how they contribute to the mission, why it's important, who believes that their voice and their choice matters because the leader invites them to, I'm very keen on this process of co-creation, how you involve others in the manifestation of your business, and it doesn't matter what it is tremendous at a psychological level for getting people then to believe that they matter. And it's interesting, we look at a most fundamental human need, it all distills down to this belief that we have value, that we matter. And if we are in environments where leaders are making it very intentional and very overt priority to include individuals, to treat them respectfully enough to invite their voice, to be candid with them about feedback, that creates a virtuous cycle that really translates into those particular organizations that we celebrate as the best places to work, or those places where people flock to, you know, get their resume in because they want to be in environments like that because it manifests their gifts and allows them to really feel that they're part of something special. Vice in other organizations where they merely feel like either cogs in the machine or just others that are doing something but aren't exactly sure how that something turns into tangible value for those they serve.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Now, so for our listeners, how do you know if your leadership skills need improving?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know that anyone's ever asked that, and I like that. So, you know, one, you can look around, okay? And how well do people
behind you? They need.
Well, that's helpful, exactly, from that standpoint. But look around and go, you know, if you're in a leadership position, which again, I believe everyone is at some level. You know, there's an interesting statistic. Sociologists tell us that the most introverted person on the planet will influence at least 10,000 people in their lifetime. That's the most introverted person on the planet, probably not anyone on this phone call. So if you can imagine, we all have dramatic effect on other people across, you know, just living our lives. So when you're thrust into a very overt, tangible, recognizable, distinguishable leadership position, imagine how that ability to influence now expands. And so when you think about that, if you're in a position of leadership based on your title or position or whatever, and you now, the individuals, you look at the byproduct of your leadership, how willing are people to be able to give you honest feedback? How willing are people to take risks? If you're in an organization where your leadership is, say, is not as effective, you're going to see that feedback will shut down because communication will be watered down. You'll find that people's willingness to risk failure is going to go down to almost a zero tolerance type of sense. When you look at the ability for individuals, how much are they giving? I mean, you can tell from the level of creativity and innovation in an organization, how much are people offering over and above? Are you inviting them into a conversation, or are you directing them to what you expect them to produce in terms of outcomes? So ultimately, to answer your question, the social proof is what I call invisible in plain sight on how effective you are as a leader. And it's how well engaged your people are, how well informed your people are staying, how much are they really, are they delivering the minimum? Or are you seeing that they're always now coming with new and creative ways and they feel safe enough by your leadership to be able to sometimes respectfully say, I hear you, but there could be a different way. So you go back to this whole concept of effective leaders create conditions for other people to feel safe enough to give their best, be their best, and do their best. So if you look around and all you see is people doing the minimum, you might have the answer to the question.
Well, that is so much along the lines of what I picked up when I first came across your work on Twitter. And then in your book, one of the phrases that really jumped out at me was you talk about others-centered leadership. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because I think it speaks to the issues that you were just talking about.
Well, thank you for letting me unpack that a bit, because, yes, I'm quite passionate about that. We live in a world that, if we're honest, a lot of manifestations of leadership show up as self-interest. What I mean is, because of marketing and just the way that things are in certain societies, the leader, it's very easy as a leader to be able to fall into a cycle of either self-protection, self-promotion, and just look around. I mean, you see it. A lot of the type of things we see in social media, when you watch the news, when you look in the print news, all those things tend to be, pushing out certain people in a way that glorifies themselves. But if you really, interestingly, look across history, and you can pick an example, whether I picked an MLK, you can pick anybody who has had dramatic positive effect in their sphere of influence. Some sphere of influence could have been a dozen. Other sphere of influence could have been millions. You'll find that not a single one of them was self-focused, self-oriented, or self-interested. They were always focused on the other. All the way back, quite candidly, you go back to 2,000 years ago, and you have a consistent dialogue or a picture that emerges of the most effective individuals are those who believed that if I can actually focus on the other and then do all I can to create conditions for them to really become and grow into their potential, what you find is they themselves are willing to give back so much more that it'll lead to your own success. So it's a matter of where's the orientation. I believe if you orient out and consistently try to be and do your best, people will be very, very happy then, because they'll respond to that. It's a natural cycle how I believe human beings were created, that they will then give their best and think about. That's the virtuous cycle. Unfortunately, you look at a lot of the failures we have in leadership. There are very Enron. You can just look through the whole one after the other. You can look at it with politicians. Insert leadership figure here. You will find that when they're failing, and what happens where that is becomes very uninspiring to us is there's a level of self-interest that is the root cause. So we have to fight that as human beings, because at some level, especially when you're in very visible places of leadership, we wrestle with our egos. You go back to, even original Chinese thought. It's always really been grounded in this notion of how you can transcend the ego, self, in a way that is going to allow you to be the best person you can be, believing that if you do that, others will reciprocate and do the same. So it's a simple concept, but it's actually rooted in consistent history of those individuals who had the greatest positive effect on other human beings, and as a result, the world became better, not worse.
Well, you raise an interesting point that it is almost countercultural right now to have this other-centered perspective.
You are spot on. I will. You said it beautifully. It is countercultural, and you know I know that. You know, we seem, so many people seem infatuated with looking at the lives of these particular celebrities. If you would have told me years ago that all these shows about insert Housewives of X, or, I mean, there's so many things that are celebrating these one-off individuals, but what they're, if you think about it, and this is just at least from my value system, a lot of those kind of things that are manifesting, I personally don't think necessarily is what I would call the best in the human condition. We don't have near as many things that talk about people who are doing great things. You know, the people invisible in plain sight who are doing every single day that are out there serving. We do a little bit with the military, and I think this is why I'm drawn so much to mission and why I really didn't want to go in the military initially, but 26 years, because I was captivated by the amazing sense of selflessness every day. I mean, I saw it. I saw it in battle repeatedly, but I saw it in peacetime repeatedly. And quite honestly, that's quite inspiring. I do not see that same thing manifested politics right now. I see so many levels where people are hungry, quite honestly, starved for examples of positive role models who are willing to be more selfless than they are selfish.
Well, listen, let's get down to, pardon the cliche, but let's get down to brass tacks here.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about your personal process. When you, over the years, have found yourself in a new situation or find yourself working with a new team or a new project, what is your internal checklist for evaluating the situation and beginning to strategize?
So, okay, I've got a couple of things that I consistently have applied, and you talked, you know, very graciously in your opening about 26 years. Let me just paint a little bit of this picture up front, so it'll inform these why I've kind of followed this internalized checklist. One of the things that I was very fortunate to do was lead at the institutional multi-billion-dollar level on three different occasions for the Department of Defense, projects that were considered, I mean, really significant structural change, right? And trying to move something from an underperforming condition and in fairly short order moving it to where it was ideally moving to almost be in an optimized condition. And so what I found is consistently, and no matter what it was, whether it was in warfare, was in building the strategy for our global transportation system, I from day one realized that first thing you want to do when you walk in is honor history. What I mean by that, when you're dealing with change, it's very disruptive, obviously, to individuals for a lot of reasons. And individuals who aren't necessarily sensitive to taking the time to understand what has happened in the past that you should celebrate very tangibly, so that what you're informing people by that is you're being respectful about what's happened before you got there. And then how do you build on that strength? And there's a reason for this psychologically and emotionally when you're talking about helping people through change, is if you're going to make someone go from one place that they're very comfortable in, it may not be functional, it may not be great, but they're comfortable in it, to some place that is yet undetermined, that obviously is a scary, you know, it's a scary deal. One thing that the people who are very affected, I've always tried to do, is to be able to give people something to carry from their present state into the future. It almost serves as a security blanket. So one, every situation I go into, I said, what can I learn about the past? What can I honor about the history here? And how do I build on this strength? How do I take some things and use that as the catapult to go forward? The second thing I do is I always look for people not like me. We have this tendency, as you know, as human beings, to be able to surround ourselves with people that talk like us, look like us, kind of reflect us back to ourselves. I actually found that if you really want to succeed, and you, especially the harder the task, is create what I call coalitions of the unlikely. Find people not like you who have different strengths, may even speak a completely different vernacular, and knit them together because you're sending a powerful message about your willingness to be open, your willingness to invite new ideas. And in that, then you can invite this next piece, which is about how do you create conditions for co-creation. So once you've created this coalition of the unlikely, people not like you, how do you create an open dialogue that constantly invites people to iterate and never allow yourself to believe you fully have the baked answer? You may have it for a season, but we know, just like with IT development or anything else, and especially in today's world, it's a process of ongoing iteration. And then the last part of that, you know, is I always do the best that I can to make myself very available to people and to where I can make myself safe. And what I mean by safe is once you've done those other things, you've created conditions to start to establish some momentum. People now, if they really are going to give the best of themselves to do something, whether it's easy or really, really hard, have to believe that the leader themselves is going to be transparent with them. They're going to be open to, again, a diverse set of ideas, and that if things don't quite work out as they should, the first orientation is to acknowledge. The second thing is to be able to say, what can we learn from that? And then third is how we actually take that learning and use it to inform the path you want to go forward. That's how we actually make failing forward more or less an idea and actually a real-world concept. So when you take this kind of combined notion of honor history and build on strength, get people not like you, make co-creation an ongoing priority, and make yourself available to the team around you, quite honestly, none of those things require any special title. And what they do is they actually create, what's well proven, the conditions by which now we can remain very open-minded. This is where innovation flourishes and thrives, and this is where real breakthrough performance occurs.
You know, over the course of my career, I'm old enough to remember a time when conventional wisdom was you just come in and fire somebody to get everybody's attention. You know, that seems in the context of what you're discussing and what we've learned in the intervening years, it seems to, that's almost like bloodletting in the medical field. It just seems so archaic, and yet I bet that goes on out there.
Well, it does, but I would tell you in the more progressive organizations, and we know what those progressive organizations look like. You know, we get informed by like the 100 best workplaces. And there's a series of measures of organizations that have 1,000 people for every, you know, applications for every one job. So when you look at the organizations that fall into this place where have very high employee engagement, and you realize the average employee engagement today or disengagement is 72%. 72% of people in the workforce today are disengaged. That's a leadership problem. The number one reason people leave their jobs is because of bad leaders. That's a leadership problem. But then I look at places like Google. Once again, number one. Google isn't number one because they, I know they've got decent bonuses. They give you a lot of good food and you can bring your parakeet to work. That's pretty cool. The reality is if you look at Google, their secret sauce is the fact that everything they do is engineered to maximize relationship. You realize at Google, they measure everything from the cafeteria line and the reason if to 4.5 minutes because they want to maximize your ability to talk to somebody else. They put the chairs too close together so you'll accidentally bump into somebody else. They created these long tables so you could sit across from somebody else. What's cool is if you look at all the great organizations, they understand that you thrived in today's economy when people now feel safe to come together, when you actually make relationship and fundamental respect of human beings, people do the rest of their work. They're willing to give their best. So it's funny, those organizations trapped in the old think, the bloodletting that you're describing, quite honestly, they're on a path to extinction. It's just a matter of time.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, I don't want to neglect getting to something that at least I found to be the crux of your book, and that is the four dimensions of leadership. I know we have some electrical engineers in the office. Really quickly, the four dimensions, I'm going to give them out of order, are inspire, equip, encourage, and empower. And for those electrical engineers in the audience, you might think of this as the IEEE standard for leadership. But we'll go back and put those in order. Could you talk about each one of those and give us a sense of what they mean in practical terms to a leader of an organization?
I will, and thank you for bringing that up. I mean, yes, when I really look, if you were to break down everything we've talked about in our conversation or I've written about in this or the previous book or whatever, it comes down to, it really simplifies to these elements. If you as a leader are doing these four things, equip means ask yourself every day, if I'm going to put people on mission, whatever that mission is, if I'm going to ask them to do something, have I given them all the tools in terms of training? Have I given them clarity of direction? Do they have everything they need to succeed? If you can answer yes, you can check that box. Oftentimes, people are set up for failure, we find, right at the outset, because they're told to go do this, or they're asked to go achieve this, but we know if they're not equipped with the right set of capabilities personally or provided the type of things required to pull this off professionally, they're set up for failure. So have you equipped the team for success? Two, encourage. Interestingly enough, we know from science over and over again that the number one way that you want to be able to increase high performance in your organization is to spend a little more time recognizing and celebrating people. Matter of fact, we find that 62% of people in the workforce, when they're asked what they really want, it isn't money. Believe it or not, money shows up at number three or four. It always comes back, they want to be genuinely recognized by their leader, ideally in front of their peers. It seems simple. It actually started when we were young kids. It doesn't change across the lifespan. And so how are you, ask yourself as a leader, how am I doing it encouraging the people around me? Do I periodically stop to celebrate? Do I have a mechanism by which I can highlight good performance? If you say, yes, I'm a good encourager, you can check that box. At the end of the day now, when you're looking, okay, I've equipped them and I've encouraged them, have I really empowered them? This comes to a real testimony to your, I would say, security as a leader. Great leaders see things in people that the people don't see in themselves, which means you've got to be willing to give. Empower infers I'm willing to give you some of my power. I'm willing to be able to distribute that power now in a way that's tangible. How are you giving people increased responsibility over time as they earn that responsibility? So are you centralizing at the top, or are you distributing consistently against capabilities with all those who are stepping up and into the challenge? So can I really say that as a leader, I'm doing everything I can to empower people as they demonstrate performance, stretch them a little more, give them a little more? It becomes more about them and less about you. And at the end of the day, the most important thing is role modeling. We know from the time we're very young people, and again, sociology has books, you know, crammed full, telling us that the most significant way all human beings learn is by watching other people. We're not reading it. We're not necessarily, well, maybe listening to it. It is watching. And so we know from when the times we were watching our parents to throughout our history, if we were all to pause right now and bring up a mental picture of somebody who we thought that person represents a magnificent leader, we're going to find that it was they inspire us by how they live their life. Role modeling is the crux. So if I'm role modeling, you know, the consistency of behavior, attitude, and action, now all of a sudden, those four simple steps, if we do those intentionally, I will tell you, my friend, we're likely creating conditions where people can flourish and thrive, and what that means is very positive, significant business results.
Awesome. Let me ask you a pretty specific question. Okay. Let's assume that we have in our audience some people who have kind of had an epiphany about leadership but have been in a management role for quite some time. What kind of advice would you give somebody who was looking to kind of, for lack of a better term, reboot their management style or reboot their management career? If you have merely been a manager, can you recast yourself as a leader?
Again, another great question. I absolutely believe you can. Because leadership is influence, and essentially we get to make choices about how we use our influence, I think at anywhere across the lifespan, we can choose to perhaps operate differently. So as a manager, we're probably good at organizing, and we have a series of gifts. At leading now, we're wanting to do, again, spend more time where we want to focus on the development of others and how we create conditions for others to flourish and thrive. And so there's a couple things we can do that I find very quite practical. Obviously, we need to expose ourselves to what does meaningful leadership look like. Reading biographies is the single best way to go. If you look at a number of folks, they'll tell you that they've read the great histories of the biographies of individuals and make it diverse. One of my favorites is Teddy Roosevelt. You know, I look at these for cross history, and I'll read some across the span of probably 1,000 years. And I'll look at Augustine. I'll look at, you know, modern leaders today, Steve Jobs. And there's certainly a couple of things I like there and some things I don't like there. Inform yourself through the lives of other people who are leaders. Read. The other part is, you really want a leadership, you want to step into leadership, go lead a bunch of volunteers. Whether it's in your church or your school, you want a hard job, get people who don't get paid, who are going to basically have a choice whether they show up, And I have found one of the most magnificent exercises in becoming a leader is getting yourself to try to organize and lead a bunch of volunteers in accomplishing a mission. It could be as simple as organizing a food drive for a one-time event, or spending time very tangibly with a group of volunteers who are delivering on mission in a community. Because that's the hardest form of leadership. I have none of the actual tools that I have. You know, I don't have stock options to give people. I don't have a paycheck to give them. I actually have to compel them. I have to actually get folks to want to show up, give their best consistently, and keep them motivated to keep showing up. So dealing with volunteers, and again, I've done this with a number of folks where folks have said, hey, I'd like to really become a better leader. I said, okay, well, do some of this reading, but I want you to stretch, and I want you to go find an organization you're going to volunteer with for 6 to 8 weeks, and you lead a bunch of volunteers. And it was, for those who made the journey, was truly transformative. A couple opted out early. The ones that stayed the journey understood what it really means to lead effectively.
Well, that's terrific advice. And on the point of reading, I would be remiss if I didn't suggest to our audience that they ought to read your new book. And could you just give the title and the subtitle? Because I think they're wonderful, and they're wonderful together.
Well, thank you. So this new book, which I wrote in Afghanistan, so I'll put a little pre-context on there. When I was asked to go out there and lead NATO's efforts, you indicate in the beginning I had 14 nations. So 14 nations, 14 different cultures, 14 different languages. Now, all of them spoke some basic level English, so I had to find a simple way to be able to bring us together and unified around our mission. And I did that every week. Every Sunday, I wrote something called the Sunday Soundbite. And it was a lesson about how to show up in a way that is going to compel the people around you to, you know, essentially raise the bar on their performance. So the art, I captured all these because they came quite popular. About week 8 or 10, these were being sent all around the world, and we were able to, you know, we realized that, we might want to go ahead and turn these into a book when this adventure is done. So that book became The Art of Positive Leadership, Becoming a Person Worth Following. And I actually think that that's really what it's about. And this subtext of how can we use our influence in just very simple ways. And I think you'll see, since you read it, it's 52 short chapters about practical ways that we can actually add value to our surroundings, in our homes, with our spouses, with our kids, in our communities, and certainly in our workplaces. And the best part about it, I think, is like I do with all the books that I write, 100% of everything, of every book sold, goes to military charities and to help those who continue to serve on the front lines.
That's wonderful. Well, General, we have come to the end of our time together. I want to thank you for your time and for getting business matters off to such a terrific start. This was great.
Well, thank you again for letting me be the inaugural teammate. Know that I'm grateful to you and the audience for allowing me to engage and at least share some perspective. And I'm grateful for you and what you're doing and creating this new mechanism, this new opportunity for people to be engaged so they can grow themselves as individuals and as leaders.
Well, great. Thank you again. This is terrific.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Our thanks to General John Michel and to George Colombo, host of Interop Radio's Business Matters. Now, we're reaching the end of the audio portion of the show, but as you know, this is not the end of Interop Radio. No siree. We've still got this great online conversation going. It's going to continue, and we'd love to have your voice in the discussion. To do that, all you have to do is type your comment or question into the box helpfully labeled your post, and then be sure to click that big red post button underneath. Now, if you're listening to this live, thanks for being here. We hope that you will join us as well tomorrow, that's Wednesday, July 29th, for IT Life Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern. That'll be hosted by Dave Wagner. He's got a blog post about that coming up. It's a great show on user interface and user experience. You don't want to miss that show. And then, of course, on Friday, as we always do, we have Information Week Live, bringing you a discussion about the top stories in IT this week. Well, for George Colombo and everyone here at Interop Radio's Business Matters, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you on the web.